Yes, my name is Judith Heilman. I'm originally from San Francisco, raised in the South San Francisco Bay Area. Straight out of university, I became a cop. I retired out on a medical for bad knees. That's why I'm walking around with a limp and with a cane right now, because I am getting over another major knee surgery. It was, I had to keep in shape for that job, and aerobic fitness was really important, and so I really got into long-distance running, and I chewed up my knees, along with being a banshee mobile skier, so... Anyway, it was fun while it lasted. So I retired out as a detective sergeant in charge of the rape, robbery, homicide squad. Yes, I could tell you stories that would make your hair curl and fall out, but why? Just understand that, especially as a black person, as a black woman, that I have a unique perspective on law enforcement, and I do know what I'm talking about law enforcement. Okay? Please don't doubt me. All right? And yeah, I have done a lot of things, and I formed this organization about 2 years ago because I was pretty fed up with the amount of racism, bigotry, and prejudice towards historically marginalized, disenfranchised, and oppressed people in the nation. And since I lived in Montana, I wanted to take care of it here in Montana, since I had the skills and abilities and experience to do so. Okay? Aspen here, by the way, we're all still volunteer, including me. So, therefore, we have our tip jar over there. I can also take credit cards. Aspen is one of our key volunteers. She helps teach a lot of things. She's key in our Dismantling Hatred workshop, which is 6 hours long. It's all about dismantling hatred, skills and strategies you can use, and it is super, super effective. Who in here has been to that workshop? Yes, we have two people who have been to that workshop. Yeah, amazing. Thank you, thank you. We don't have another one yet scheduled for Bozeman. We do have one scheduled for Missoula on December 2nd and another one in Helena on January 27th. So we just haven't had time to schedule that. And we also have one on how to talk to kids about race, which is 4 hours, which is also really popular. We don't have that one on the books yet either, but we just finished doing that to the Montana Young Childhood Educators annual conference in Helena last month or month before. So, Aspen, I would like you to introduce yourself, please.
Okay. I'm going to have to stand on the other side of the podium. Excuse me.
So as not to strangle Judith with the microphone cord, I feel like that'd get us off to a right start. My name is Aspen Cowan. I'm a Bozeman native and an alumna of MSU. I did both my undergraduate and my graduate work in the English department there and have a graduate degree in English literature. I'm a full-time parent at the moment. I have a five-year-old, so he's almost 5 year old son. My husband, also a Bozeman native, so we really love this tent. This is home to us, and Montana is home to us going back quite a ways. And so being involved with Montana Rep has been really invaluable because it's making a difference here where we are. And it's one of the things that we really would love to have you guys take away today is the extent to which this happens here in Montana, here in Bozeman, that this is not an abstract problem, that racism is not something that happens somewhere else where there are people of color. And here where it's in Montana, obviously not a problem. The truth is that it does happen here, and that being involved with Montana Rep has been a really great opportunity to help people work on solving the issue where we are. So.
Hi, Pat. All right, and I do want to say that I've been living here in Montana, particularly in Bozeman, for over 12 years, so I do know Montana, and I've traveled the state extensively, including the reservations extensively, so, yeah, all right. So so Paula asked me in particular if we'd be interested, thank you, Paula, in doing this, and seeing as how I'm a fan of this monthly thing, I said yes. So we're going to be talking about, basically, you can see what I've titled this as, Overload. And that picture of that man going like this is pretty much me all the time. Probably Aspen too. So let's go into what we're going to be doing. First off, I do want to acknowledge that we are sitting and standing on ground occupied for tens of thousands of years by Native Americans, and that this country was founded on genocide and slavery, and that's where its that is where its money came from. That's where this country's wealth came from. So let's acknowledge that and move forward. We're only just going to be scanning the surface for an hour, a little bit more than an hour. We want to allow plenty of time for Q&A. This is really, really important. Just know that this we can only address this deep, deep issue of racism in our country and in our state and in our city just very surface, okay? Helena, would you do us a favor and continue to take pictures through the time period? Thank you so much. All right. So some of the issues, we're going to be addressing only some of the issues facing historically marginalized, disenfranchised, and oppressed people in Montana. You may hear me refer to HMDOs. That is the acronym for historically marginalized, disenfranchised, and oppressed people that I made up. Okay? You're probably not going to hear it anywhere else. I'm just saving some syllables. So we're going to show some examples of the omnipresent negative narrative that is just exhausting. And if you're tired of hearing about racism. And then we're going to talk about transformational change. And so we're going to go into the criminal justice system here. And I don't know why, but I'm going to have to back out of this because it's not showing. For some reason, I lost my animation. So you're going to see this screen right here. Police overreach. It's constant. Not every cop, of course. Of course not. And I tend to think that, and I tend to believe, based on experience, that most cops are great cops. But there are the ones that are the rotten eggs that definitely need to go. There are some departments that are super ethical all the way across the board. Of course, they've got a handful of road cops that always need to be weeded out. There are some departments, especially major-sized departments, but also some smaller ones, that are just plain old corrupt because they've gotten a critical mass of sworn and civilian staff who are not fair and equitable. Let's put it that way. The problems are implicit and explicit bias. Explicit bias is, you know, bias that shows people who call people derogatory names, epithets, people who believe that all black people are thugs, people who believe that all Native Americans are drunk and idle and stupid people, you know, all that kind of stuff. Implicit bias is where you think you're just fine, but it's that thing where you're walking down the street and you hug your person closer because a black person's heading towards you in the opposite direction, and then you realize, like, you may not even realize you're doing that, but you're doing it. That's an implicit bias. Okay? Sandra Bland, she's a great example of police overreach. How many in here recognize that name, Sandra Bland? That's good. Sandra Bland was a black woman who had just been accepted to a position in her alma mater, a paid position in Texas. She was so excited about it. She drove down from Illinois, I think she lived in the Chicago area, I'm not sure, to go to this new job. The day she gets into town, she's driving by the university. She gets pulled over by a cop for failing to signal a right turn. Now, I will tell you, as a cop, that's a chicken shit stop. You only do that when you really, really want to find out who's in the car. And who's to say that she really did or did not fail to signal her right turn. But anyway, he was negative from the get-go. He went up to go hand her the ticket, ask her to sign it. She's sitting in the car. She's smoking a cigarette. He demands she puts out her cigarette. She refuses. Why should she? It's not important that she put out her cigarette. And then he demands that she get out of the car, and saying that he'll light her up if she doesn't get out of the car. So finally she gets out of the car. She's really pissed off. And next thing you know, she gets arrested. She gets tackled to the ground. She gets thrown in jail. And 3 days later, she's found hanging in her jail cell. Now, the sheriff's office says that it was suicide. Her family insists that she would never do something like that. So all this was over a police stop, a traffic stop, for failing to make a right turn. Now, would you call that police overreach or not, how all this happened? I mean, why demand that she even get out of the car? That's called escalation rather than de-escalation. Laws that target people of color. Currently, we have everybody is recognizing that we have an opioid crisis, what's called an opioid crisis across America, including here in Montana. And we had a crack epidemic in the 70s and 80s, and which just destroyed the black community. And the response by the government response was to make it a war on drugs. And this crack epidemic affected mostly black people, mostly people of color. The opioid crisis is affecting pretty much everyone, but a lot more white people than the crack one did. So it's deemed a crisis, and it's a national public health crisis, whereas it was a war on drugs for black people. And a lot of black people are still in prison for being found with crack back in the day. And nowadays, all the police forces and the fire departments and everybody, they carry around Narcan for overdoses, just to give somebody an antidote to an overdose. And then after they recover, they maybe go to the emergency room and then they're on their way. Okay, so then there's also unjust detentions and stop and frisk, which is all the statistics are out there about how people of color are much more negatively affected by this. There's a term called broken windows policing, and that stands for police officers, line officers, patrol officers going after the people who are, how would you describe it? The people who are on the streets and mostly struggling, like, why are you standing around loitering on the streets, you know? So that's another thing. Unjust arrests. Lots of times, say for instance with the Sandra Bland thing, that was going to be thrown out of court. And yet and still, she had been arrested, she was in jail for 3 days, and found hanging. So many times somebody gets tased 21 times over nothing. They weren't they were thought to be a suspect. They weren't a suspect. They didn't even look like the suspect description. And they get arrested. They get tackled. The person's like, I didn't do anything. They get tackled to the ground, and they're charged with resisting arrest. And then come to find out that the DA doesn't file the charges on that. But still, yet and still, they got tackled. They went through all this trauma. They're in jail, they've got a record, and maybe their name was in the newspaper and all that kind of stuff, so their reputation is ruined. That's pretty crummy stuff, okay? Child access to loaded firearms, this is another aspect that you guys may not realize. And I'm speaking from experience here. I spent a year working for Everytown for Gun Safety. I'm working on reducing gun violence. And child access to loaded firearms was a big, big deal. It was one of the things that I was on a shootings review team that we looked over every week. So many children get access to a loaded firearm and shoot and kill themselves or a sibling or a parent or a friend every week across this country. It's horrible. It's horrible. But I will tell you that if the parents or if the responsible adults to that child were white, they are rarely charged because they've, quote-unquote, suffered enough. But unless they had missing teeth, they had warrants for their arrest, they were living in a motel from week to week, but if the responsible adults were people of color, they were always charged. This is in all 50 states. It's not like It's not like police departments and sheriff departments and law enforcement agencies all across the country have this conspiracy. They don't call up one another and say, let's all do this. This is the air we breathe. I do want to say that just 3 days ago, the United States Sentencing Commission, a bipartisan independent agency created by an act of Congress that operates within the judicial branch, released this report on race and incarceration by the numbers. And there were all sorts of disparities discovered that were after controlling for a wide variety of sentencing factors, including age, education, citizenship, weapon possession, and prior criminal history. I'm going to try to click on a video here. Let's see if I can do this. You can find this in today's Washington Post. Okay. Judges are less likely to voluntarily revise sentences downward for black offenders than for white ones. And even when judges do reduce black offenders' sentences, they do so by smaller amounts than for white offenders. Now remember, this is a study by a bipartisan independent agency that is part of the judicial branch. However, decisions by federal prosecutors, whether to seek a charge carrying a mandatory minimum sentence, for instance, are also driving the disparities. The charging decisions of prosecutors, the DAs, are key. Whether done consciously or not, prosecutors are more likely to charge African Americans with such charges than whites. It just drives us nuts.
So the criminal justice system is not the only area in which we see disparities like this. For example, the pay gap has been talked about a lot, and I would wager that everybody in this room has heard the statistic that a woman makes 76 cents on the dollar for every dollar that a man makes in the same amount of time, right? That's for white women. Black, Hispanic, and Native American women all make substantially less. In the state of Montana specifically, Native American women earn 93% of what white women earn, but 67% of what Montana Manhunt. So one of the organizations that we follow actually does what's called equal pay days throughout the year, and what that is the day they announce, okay, today this group of women caught up with what white men earned last year. Native American Women's Pay Day is in October. October of the following year. That's how long it takes a Native American woman to catch up to what a white man earns.
And Hispanic is the next month, I think.
Yeah. And just so we're clear, total earnings takes into account other factors like unemployment, underemployment, and when you do those numbers, Native American women earn 44%, and Native American men earn 56% of what the average man in Montana, these are Montana numbers, what the average male Montanan earns. So this is doing the same amount of work, making less than half or just barely more than half for the same kind of work.
Is this stuff new to... How many in here are learning new things? Please let us know by raising your hands. Okay, thank you. All right.
Disparities also exist in education programs. Minority and low-income students, those two groups overlap frequently enough that the Venn diagram is like a pyramid, you know what I mean? Are underrepresented in gifted programs and advanced placement programs. Black students are 66% less likely to be referred to gifted programs in the math and reading areas than white classmates.
It's not because we're stupid.
No, it has to do entirely with who recommends them, which the educators making recommendations are overwhelmingly white. Hispanic students are 47% less likely. But when students are taught by a teacher of their own race, then they're three times, with this is specifically black students, they're three times more likely to be recommended. This is clearly about who's doing the judging and who's doing the recommending. In Broward County, Florida, the school system saw a 130% increase in the gifted rate among Latino students and an 80% increase among black students after they implemented a universal screening program. So essentially, they basically created a blind scenario where you didn't know the race of the student who was being evaluated. And unfortunately, budget cuts have since canceled that program, which is another, you know, how schools are budgeted, who gets the money for education is another huge part of education disparity.
There was, as I recall, it was the new universal screening process was put in under a more progressive governor under his education department, and then when Rick Scott came in, who's much more conservative governor there in Florida, this part of the program got cut. Those stats are shocking. 130% increase in the gifted rate among Latinos and 80% among black students after implementing a universal screening process. Now it's back to how it was before, because it had only been done for a year or two, no more than 2 years, before that program got cut.
We also talk a lot when we're talking about racism in education, we talk about what's called the school to prison pipeline. And what essentially this is it's the setting up of black students to be institutionalized later in life. It's the product of a consistent attitude towards black students that they are not as smart, that they're not as motivated, that they're basically not going to go anywhere anyway. Which results in, essentially, you funnel those children towards inevitable incarceration, which is societally pushed. For example, one aspect of this is multiple studies have shown that black children, and especially black boys, are consistently seen at, by white observers, by white authority figures, as older and more mature than their actual age, by as much as 7 years. So just to give you an example, I have a 7-year-old nephew, and he's a tall kid, and he's black. And this statistic suggests that people look at him and think that he is a 14-year-old, that he's a high school student, because he's black. This is most vividly been shown publicly in the killing of Tamir Rice. Tamir Rice was a little boy playing at the park. He had a, I forget if it was like a cap gun.
He was 12, yeah. I think it was a cap gun or a rifle. I can't remember which.
He was
a toy.
12 years old and playing with a toy gun. And a cop rolled up and within literal seconds shot him dead. Because he didn't see a little boy playing. He saw a black guy with a gun.
That cop later said he thought that 12-year-old Tamir Rice was 20.
And just to be clear, just so we understand each other, not only... I'm sorry, this is a very emotional subject.
Yeah.
Not only did he not see a little boy playing, but he did not see an innocent person. Like, Tamir Rice, if he had been 20, had not been accused of a crime, this cop was not looking for a suspect in any kind of shooting.
And it's an open carry state.
And it was an open carry state. He literally, even if he had been 20, committed no crime. Even if he'd been 20 and he'd been carrying an assault rifle, he would have committed no crime. 2.5 seconds. I have a really hard time talking.
Okay,
so do I. Black girls experience the same thing, but with them also comes sexualization. My niece is, my nephew is 8, my niece is 7. My niece is 7, and she's black, and that means that at 7 years old, people are already talking about how she works it. Like, girl, she's so working it. Inevitably, this is white people, by the way, which is creepy. She's 7, but she's already seen as inherently a sexual being, a more sexual being than a 7-year-old white girl. This has been statistically proven. This has been shown in study after study that this way of seeing little children persists and influences the ways that they are treated in schools. Black boys are treated as troublemakers in schools. They're punished more harshly for doing the exact same thing that white boys do. They're suspended at a higher rate, both black boys and black girls. Are suspended at a higher rate for the same infractions, and that starts in kindergarten.
Preschool,
excuse me. 5 years old. 5-year-old children being suspended from school multiple times a year for being black. Absolutely.
If you go back in the Washington Post in July of 2014, there's a first-person article written by a woman who's a mom to 2 children, 2 little black boys, 3 and 5. And her 3-year-old, at the time she wrote it, and this is a headline, and it caught my attention, it should catch yours. My son has been suspended from preschool 5 times. He's 3. And you read the article, and they are all minor things. They are all typical kid things. And she did not realize until she was talking with a group of moms from the same class and telling them about this, that one mom said, my son threw a chair at another kid, and the kid had to go to the emergency room, and all I got was a phone call. So you combine all that stuff along with kids who are gifted and not challenged. How many of you know about the problem with gifted students who are not recognized as gifted and they are totally bored in regular classes and they get in trouble, they get suspended because they're not challenged. They're not challenged. And so that's why it's really important for us to share this thing about gifted students and also this other stuff. So you put all these things together, you've got this toxic mix, right?
So just in conclusion, one other thing I wanted, we had on the last slide about the school to prison pipeline. It's cool, I can. The minute a child is influenced by the criminal justice system, and that can be the school cop being involved in their suspension, or their parent being arrested and them being in foster care for a couple of days while things get sorted out, their parent being incarcerated for a long period of time. The minute that a child is touched in any way by the criminal justice system, they're statistically more likely to end up in the system themselves as they get older. And when you couple that with what we've already showed you about the disproportionate and unjust way in which minority parents are incarcerated, you can see how this is a monster that self-perpetuates itself. So, moving on. So these are sort of big things that can be proved with studies. We have evidence and data to back these up. But they are all sort of part of this larger overarching cultural thing. How many people here, just a quick show of hands, are familiar with the term white privilege? Because I won't spend a ton of time on it. Okay, great. I'm so glad to see some hands. Look at that.
Yeah, that's great.
But yeah, so I'm just going to, you know.
We won't even show the
Yeah, phone. This is a really succinct thing. White privilege is my history, being a part of the core curriculum, being the core curriculum, and Judith's history, being an elective. White privilege is 11 months of the year, white history. 1 month of the year, black history. 1 month of the year, Hispanic history. 1 month of the year, Native American history. And 12 months of the year, realistically, since inevitably those months always involve what white people were doing.
All right, I'm going to take this one. Racism is bad for one's health. Can we just say that? Oh, gosh. The rates of heart disease and high blood pressure are so much higher in African Americans. That is a study by the National Institutes of Health. Several studies show that African American patients are often prescribed less pain medication than white patients with the same complaints. I have multiple personal experiences with that. Multiple. One of the most recent was when I'd had a major knee surgery my pain was way beyond the medication that I'd been given by my doctor. And so I went over to Bozeman Health and to the emergency room, and I was afraid I had a blood clot in my knee. I was really afraid of that, and I was going to throw it, and I was going to stroke out, and all this kind of stuff. So, and my knee was super swollen. It was super swollen. And so I went in there, and the person who was checking me in said, "So you want more pain medication?" I was like, "I'm afraid I have a blood clot." You know, it was just, that just really fried me. I've also had other minor surgeries, you know, like in and out, outpatient and stuff like that, where I was just told that aspirin would be just fine, and it was not. I had to have something taken out of my cheek, off my cheekbone, and not off the bone itself, but of the skin, and several stitches and everything. And I was told aspirin or Tylenol or whatever would be just fine, and I was dying. I called my regular general physician, and she called in a pain medication prescription for me, saying that's ridiculous. Of course, it's ridiculous. But yeah. Black patients with chest pain are referred for advanced cardiac care less often than white patients with identical symptoms. This also has to do with breast cancer and uterine cancer with black women as well. We get the treatment a lot later than the white population. There are studies on that as well. So, and the association between discrimination and major depressive disorder among black people is well known. That's also a study by the National Institutes of Health. And that also goes for Native Americans, brown people, too. So a new group of studies into racial disparities among people with Alzheimer's disease suggests that social conditions including the stress of poverty and racism, substantially raise the risk of dementia for African Americans. Honey, you're going to keep an eye on me, right? My husband's in the audience. Intergenerational trauma related to systemic racism is one of the reasons behind the opioid addiction in Indian country, according to a study by the Pew Charitable Trusts. The federal government is not addressing the epidemic with dollars and is only acknowledging white victims as opposed to black suspects, brown suspects with the crack epidemic. I forgot to put my close parentheses on there. So
one thing I do want to acknowledge is many of these studies have been done with specifically black populations. And so we often refer to studies with black statistics, but these issues affect non-white people across the board to varying degrees. So we are in no way meaning to suggest when we cite those studies that Native American, Hispanic, or Asian communities don't face these issues. They do, it's just, you know, frequently the studies we can best draw from have specifically looked at the African American population. So all of this, as you can kind of tell, builds up to a huge kind of narrative in society. And that narrative informs what we talked about earlier with the implicit racism of how people treat people of color. Black and brown people aren't as capable as white people. They're not as smart as white people. They don't feel pain the same way white people feel pain. Unless, of course, they're athletes or musicians or dancers. Like, clearly black people are super good at music. You know what I mean? You all know what I mean. So clearly black people can play football, but they're not great quarterbacks, for example. Which is obviously not true. But have you ever noticed that? The sheer number of football teams where the white guy is the one calling the shots and he's like the only white player on the field? Yeah. Ever stopped and thought about that for a second? The black guys are the ones who take the hits and the white guy is the one that calls the shots.
Yeah.
Another aspect of the negative narrative that we see is colorblindness. And I have been guilty of this myself. This is sort of the race. This is as close as I got to anti-racism as a child was... I don't see color. I don't see other people as black or brown or Indian or Asian. I just see people. I just see the human race. Sometimes I accidentally say a swear in these affairs. I try really hard not to, especially when people are recording. But that's ridiculous. Okay? Colorblindness is garbage. It does nobody any good. Colorblindness doesn't mean that you're a good person. Colorblindness means that you are refusing to see the lived experience of anybody who isn't white. If their experience differs from the white experience, you refuse to see it. If they try to talk to you about their pain and it's not the same as white pain, you just don't see it. And that makes you, if you'll excuse me, useless.
It also doesn't acknowledge her.
It doesn't acknowledge the experiences of people who are not you. It doesn't acknowledge the issues that those people go through. Colorblindness doesn't make people of color feel better. It makes them feel invisible. In addition to this, who is familiar with the term gaslighting as a psychological concept? Okay, so gaslighting comes... from this old movie, Gaslight, where the husband tries to drive his wife crazy by messing with how bright the lights are in the house, and then telling her that nothing's going on and she's imagining it and she just is obviously crazy. So when we talk about gaslighting, what we mean is trying to tell people that what they feel, experience, have lived through isn't there, isn't real, they're imagining it, they're overblowing it. White people have no business defining racism. White people have no business defining racism.
Need to hear that again?
Yeah, I'll say it again. I could just do that for the rest of the podcast if you want. White people have no business deciding what socially needs to be done about racism. Because frankly, white people have done a really terrible job at doing that so far. It is gaslighting to tell a person that they have not experienced racism. it's gaslighting to say, well, I've never seen people be racist in Bozeman if you are a white person. Of course you haven't. You've never had to. Coupled with this is, real briefly, the idea of reverse racism. There's a whole big thing. Reverse racism is not a thing. And I'm really sorry if a minority has been mean to you in your life. I am. Like, I'm legitimately sorry. I'm not being facetious. Like, but racism is about all of these structural, societal things that we've shown you. Racism is about the whole structure of a society being designed to step on you. And as a white person, no matter how mean a black cashier is to you, no matter how snubbed you feel when somebody cuts you off in traffic, you will never experience that entire system designed to step on your neck. Reverse racism is not real. Part of the negative narrative that we hear a lot, Black Lives Matter. Well, don't all lives matter? I mean, like, patently, obviously not, based on everything we've showed you today, right? Like, if all lives matter, then why do black people go to prison at so much higher of a rate for the same crimes? Why is a 12-year-old little boy dead for something that it wasn't wrong on any level, if all lives matter, if his life mattered as much as yours? Black Lives Matter doesn't mean to suggest that black lives matter more than yours. It means to suggest that they matter as much as yours, and that the society we live in doesn't acknowledge that and needs to.
Yeah.
Tone policing, is this another phrase that maybe people have or haven't heard? No, okay. Tone policing is when you get mad at a person of a minority group for the way in which they express their pain and the way in which they express their outrage. Well, if you would be nicer, if you would be more civil, if you wouldn't swear, if you wouldn't come off as so angry, how can you see all this and not be angry? And it's not happening to you, right? Like, if this doesn't make you furious just on a base human level, like, tone policing is trying to tell the person who has been injured, that is hurting, that their pain is being inappropriately expressed. And it is completely useless as a tool. Because the truth is, no matter how nice people of color are, no matter how polite they are, no matter how subservient they are, nothing will change until we make it change, until we all make it change. And telling people to be more polite about how upset they are and to stop blocking traffic with their protests is not helpful. You're addressing the wrong problem. Real briefly, the one other negative narrative item that we'd like to talk about, I know we're sort of running our time, but that's what happens. The idea of the melting pot. This goes back to the idea of colorblindness. A melting pot implied... Blah, blah, blah. Lost my ability to talk, I apologize. Melting pot implies that we're all going to sort of amalgamate into this homogenous, you know, sort of like, I always picture like queso, you know? But like realistically, melting pot implies that we're all going to sort of even out to the base level, to the majority level, which is white. We prefer the metaphor of a mixed salad, where everybody's all in the same bowl together, where America is the bowl or whatever. But we all retain our separate individual identities, the things that make us human beings, the experiences we've lived through, and we're not expected to give that up to sort of become Velveeta-y.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is just part of it. Black and brown people are always at fault when something bad happens to them.
Yeah. The bottom one, here is a headline from a newspaper. This happened when a little black child fell into a zoo enclosure with a gorilla named Harambe, and this happened in Cleveland, I think, or somewhere in Ohio.
Yeah.
It was Cleveland, okay. And anyway, the mom had been there, and it was an outing with several families. Anyway, this little kid, as little kids are wont to do, scooted away, and before you know it, he's down in the gorilla enclosure. And the headline is talking about the father who was not even there.
Who was a non-custodial parent.
Who was a non-custodial parent. And they're talking about the father's criminal history. This is constant. This is why this is called overload. All of this stuff is constant. It's constant. Media and advertising bias. Oh my gosh. Okay, so I know Paula was really excited about me showing this this one thing with the gun up there, but before I even get to that, this is off a Dove bottle of something, some lotion, for normal to dark skin. I think you all are getting that based on the chuckles that I'm hearing. Okay, so you think that's funny. We don't. We don't. The American News Guide to Violence, you know, with all these mass shootings that we're having, if it's a white person, they're a disturbed loner. If they're black, they're a thug. And if they're white, they're a terrorist. Have you guys noticed that trend?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, this other thing up here has to do with an advertisement for background checks. Now, there is a misspelling in there. I'm not responsible for it. I didn't put this together. But I found this, okay? So this is the... Let's analyze this image that's constructed. You have this white background with white people. You see at least one person there wearing a business suit. There's three white people there. You can see two white faces and another white hand. And maybe there's more white people there. I can't quite tell because there's another hand down in there. And then you have a black person wearing a black jacket or something and a black watch holding a black gun. And in front of them, it looks very threatening. Now, you're kind of wondering, like, is anybody wondering what the Band-Aid's all about? That's a flesh-colored Band-Aid, and whose flesh does it represent? It's not my flesh. This is how Band-Aids are marketed. It's flesh-colored Band-Aids. But it's not the flesh. It's only the flesh of, like, supposed to be representing the flesh of white people. So that is intended to show out more of a disparity between that person holding this threatening gun, a black hand in all black holding a black gun, to show the difference between that person and the white people in the background. Slick, huh? Gosh, I just get so angry when I see all these things. So I do want to stress that anti-police brutality is not anti-police. We can protest brutality and support good police. We do not have to choose. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. And finally, and I'm not going to play this, but I'm going to play it. Just up to 153. Just because it's really good. John Stewart's timing and everything.
This isn't all about just one man killed in one town. It's about how people of color, no matter their socioeconomic standing, face obstacles in this country with surprising grace. Imagine that instead of that, on a pretty consistent basis, you can't get a cat, even though you're a neurosurgeon, because you're black. I guarantee you that every person of color in this country has faced an indignity, from the ridiculous to the grotesque to the sometimes fatal, at some point in their, I'm going to say, last couple of hours. Because of their skin color. Quick story. So we live in New York City, a liberal bastion. Recently, let me finish. Recently, Twitter sent a correspondent and a producer to a building in this liberal bastion where we were going to take an interview. The producer, white, dressed in what could only be described as homeless elf attire. And pretty strong 5 o'clock from the previous week shadow, strode confidently into the building, preceding our humble correspondent, a gentleman of color, dressed resplendently in a tailored suit. Who do you think was stopped? Let me give you a hint, the black. And that happens all the time. All of it. Race is there, and it is a constant. You're tired of hearing about it? Imagine how exhausting it is.
And that's the truth. Get it? We've been pounding this into heads enough. So just in wrapping this up before we go to Q&A, we just want to say an injustice to one is an injustice to all. That's a concept I hope everyone in here can agree on, but do we apply it? Do we apply that concept? And our challenge is to everyone here to apply that concept, to understand that if I'm experiencing an injustice, you as a white person are also experiencing that injustice. Someone who's LGBTQ, someone who is Muslim, especially a woman wearing a hijab, you know, someone who is disabled, maybe only has one leg. It's white people who made this mess, and it's white people who are in charge, so it's up to white people to fix it. Yeah? Now, that's blunt. Somebody said when I said this before that accused me of having extremist rhetoric. Now, is that tone policing or what? But it's the truth. I mean, do you understand it? I mean, think about that. Black people, Native people, we've been fighting this stuff for centuries. We're not the ones in charge. President Obama was not the one in charge. It's a we have a system of governing here that has three branches. He just represented one branch. One branch is not in charge of everything. Not two branches, it's three branches of government. The legislature, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. We ask you to listen, to learn, and repeat. Over and over and over and over again. Listen, learn, and repeat. Know that white silence is white consent. So that if you see something or hear something, if you encounter something in any way that is racist, that is bigoted or prejudiced, if you do not say something about it, if you do not write a letter about it, if you do not approach anyone about that, it is seen as justification, it is seen as consent. And in a way, you can say that silence is violence. Bystander intervention. That's a whole other thing. There's safe bystander intervention, and there's a certain way to do it. We have actually a 6-hour workshop, the Dismantling Hatred Skills and Strategies You Can Use, that we referred to earlier, that does go, spends the last like 2 hours on safe bystander intervention. Speak up for policy changes. Communicate with your elected officials. Know that they have to listen. Some of them may not. But if you don't try, they're only hearing one side. That's it. Let's open it up for Q&A.
I hear you folks have a great book club.
We do have a great book club.
Yes.
Actually, yes. The book club meets once a month
We have a rotating selection of nonfiction as well as fiction. Typically meets on a Tuesday evening.
The fourth Tuesday of the month.
I didn't realize it was on the schedule. I feel dumb. Fourth Tuesday of the month. Typically begins at
7:30 right now.
7:30, mm-hmm. And we're back to meeting in the Land Trust building. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is our last meeting in the Land Trust.
Oh, okay. Well, so this month's Land Trust. I swear to God, I can talk. I really can't. Okay, so this month we're doing a really cool book called All the Real Indians Died Off. It's a nonfiction book that addresses a number of myths and misconceptions about Native Americans in the United States. So Tuesday, November 28th, so that will be not this coming Tuesday, but the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, from 7:30 to 9 in the Gallatin Valley Land Trust Conference Room. So you're going to want to go, it's the front door, correct?
212.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the front or the back door.
Yeah, 212 in the Land Trust building, which is just right across the parking lot, kind of kitty corner here. And we have some really cool selections lined up for next year as well. So
next year, beginning January, the first meeting is January 23rd.
Let's see. You know what? I think this is going to have to go like. Well, no, I think we can do this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Beginning January, we are in partnership with the Bozeman Public Library. We'll be meeting in the small room across over here. Beginning at, let's see, 6:30 to 8, the fourth Tuesday of every month. And the book that we're reading for January is We Were 8 Years in Power by Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's just released. The book that we're going to be reading for February is Stamped from the Beginning. It's out in paperback. It's pretty thick. It's dense. It's both of them are fabulous. So start reading them now. Okay?
Okay. So, yes.
Hey, Aspen, the book for this month has a chapter on Thanksgiving.
Ooh.
It might be a great time for folks to at least read one chapter about how the Mayflower didn't actually, like, discover America. But it might be a great kind of introduction to gently show some literature to maybe some family members who might not agree with you and might not have read anything like that in a public book.
That's right. Yeah. And Angelina has been to two meetings. You want to say anything about them?
Fantastic discussions. Everyone's welcome. You don't have to have read the book. You know, if you're just there for the discussion, that's fine too. But it's a really, really wonderful gathering. So please come.
Yeah.
So this is obviously disturbing, and it always is whenever I see something like this. But are there any bright spots in Montana, in the region, in the country, in the world that you see?
I would say the most recent elections, as Judith just said, not to like steal the words out of Judith's mouth, because I try really hard not to do that. But yeah, the very most recent elections have been, that was a really great feeling to see people who had put forth, you know, to see a dude who had put forth a anti-trans bathroom bill being defeated by a trans woman in that election was like, that made me as a queer person feel just a tiny bit safer in the universe, you know what I mean? And I mean, like, y'all are sitting here, so, I mean.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I see a lot of hope in the fact that people are, that I interact with people on a regular basis who are tired of doing nothing, and that's encouraging. You know, it's encouraging to see people be tired of doing nothing.
And then you got to do something.
Yeah. Also, please do, like, don't just come here. This is not enough.
before I call on the next people. Would you do me a favor and count everybody in your form?
I did already.
You did already. Okay,
yay.
Thank you. Sir?
I think one contributing factor to the number of black, innocent blacks killed by police is the tendency of police when they use a weapon to shoot to kill rather than shoot to if they feel threatened by someone, they could disable them and then neutralize the threat, but they don't have to kill them.
All right, so here's my professional opinion on that. We shoot to kill. That doesn't that sound harsh? We aim for the largest body mass, and we practice and practice and practice. And I say this even though I've been out since 1987. So much of me is still a cop, but it's very much balanced by being a black woman in America. You practice and practice and practice, and you're under very controlled circumstances. A lot of the instruction on the practices tries to make it as stressful and as real life as possible. But the fact of the matter is, when you do get into a real life situation, you're lucky if you actually hit the person, even if you're a crack shot in the range. And because of the adrenaline, because people are moving, because your hand is shaking, all that kind of stuff. And it's, you know, this sounds awfully brutal, but it's the truth. I mean, there was one time I had pulled over somebody who I suspected had just robbed a train station, you know, where you buy your tickets and everything like that. And in fact, he was getting away in a cab. And
well, he robbed the train station, so he couldn't take the train.
That's right. You know what? That's a thing that a lot of crooks do, is they get away in a cab. And the person who was selling the tickets, who he had robbed, had described the weapon as a .45 automatic. So I knew that this wasn't just a finger in the pocket thing. The guy definitely had a weapon on him. So I pulled him over. It was what's described as a felony car stop, you know, where I'm talking on the loudspeaker to him and ordering him to get out of the car and, you know, go face down, all this kind of stuff. And I've got him at gunpoint. And I know that if he makes one false move, that I'm likely to shoot him. Because he had a .45 semi-automatic. This was early on a Sunday morning, and was on a downtown street in the city that I worked in. But in the background, about a block away, I could see a little old lady walking by with her little push cart, completely oblivious to what was going on. And by this time, my backup people had come and everything, so we all have our guns out. And my fear was that if he made one false move with her in the background, that she would end up getting shot rather than him. Because I knew, yeah, it was such a tense situation. And yes, he did have a loaded .45 with one in the chamber in his back waistband. So no. If you try to shoot to wound, you're more than likely to not actually hit that smaller part of the anatomy. That's why you aim for the body mass, which is the torso, and hope that you hit it. That's shocking. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. That's just the way it is. Please.
So my son, a cop in Anchorage, Alaska, he's a sergeant. And he's kind of bought into this Blue Lives Matter, which I hear is a dog whistle.
Yes, it is.
That's one thing I'd like you to comment on. And the other one is this new book called The End of Policing. And if you're familiar with that, I'd like to know more about it.
I'm not familiar with that new book, and Blue Lives Matter is a dog whistle.
What is
I can't hear you.
Okay, so for those of you who are not familiar with the term, a dog whistle is basically something that is designed to only be heard and understood by the people who are looking for it. So, for example, I'm trying to think of one that's really well known, but like...
Welfare Queen.
Yeah, okay, Welfare Queen. All right? And y'all nod. It's basically a phrase that signifies something different to some hearers. So when you hear Blue Lives Matter, you might, as a like non-whatever, you might think, okay, yeah, I can get behind that. Cops are important or whatever. What Blue Lives Matter means is stop complaining when cops kill black people.
Cops wear blue.
Yeah. It's specifically structured to suggest that if you are against police brutality, you must hate all police and want them to die on the job. Personally, I would love to live in a world where all police retire and we figure out a better system. But, you know, I mean, like, that's a goal someday. It's not right now. But the end of policing is related to this. This idea that there are other ways. Policing, as we understand it, has only been around since roughly the 1880s. And it has its specific roots in community groups, in people who were volunteers, essentially. And it has, in America, a lot of its roots are in slave patrols, in people who volunteered to chase escaped slaves and take them back to slavery, which is something that needs to be talked about. But so the idea that police are an integral part of society is something that a lot of people question, that there are probably other ways to do this. Just to go back real briefly to the question, I think that rather than trying to address how people get shot, we need to address the moment, the implicit biases that result in the shot being fired. This is a really personal thing for me. Without giving away a lot of details, I recently, as in the last year, lost a relative to an act of gun violence. My relative was white. The person who shot him was black. The person who shot him left the scene of the crime, kept the gun with them, was at large for roughly 24 hours before being confronted by police, and was shot dead by police in that encounter when they were found. And I cannot, in good conscience, even with my relative having been the victim of this person's violence, I cannot in good conscience sit here and tell you that if it had been a white person, that they would not have lived through that encounter with the police. Because I absolutely think, based on the facts we know, that if a white person had shot my relative, they would have been disarmed, taken into custody, put on trial, and I would have some answers for why what happened. It's about that moment before the shot gets fired. It's about what that person, as a person who has come up in our society, thinks about the people on the other end of the gun. We even if we could switch to nonviolent methods of confronting perpetrators altogether, which I think would be a great step, it won't solve the real problem, which is those implicit biases, which is the thought that goes through their head that black person with a gun not aiming the gun at them is still more dangerous than a white person doing the same thing.
And I want to get back to this shoot to kill thing a little bit more. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if I had to fire a gun and I had shot to kill, but I only had got him in the leg or the arm? Or even, like, happens on TV, but never in real life, shooting the gun out of their hand? But the bigger question is that we have a big problem with escalation rather than de-escalation in law enforcement as well. There are some cops who are more prone to escalate a situation so that it does get into a fight and does get into a situation where you do have to continually ramp up what weapon you use, other than, say, hands just trying to disable the person, you know, force the arms behind their back or something like that, rather than try to talk the situation down. I got to tell you that women cops are far better at de-escalating situations than men. Yes, what's your response?
No, a follow-up. Then I guess there's the issue when police decide to use lethal force. In some cases, you know, be firing 10 to 15 shots.
Then there is that.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, after one or two shots, they're incapacitated, so why do you need to...
That's a very good question.
...kill their body and report?
That's a very good question.
Could you repeat that?
He said, well, if you've already... If the police officer's already incapacitated the person with one or two shots, why do they keep firing? You know, make it 12, 15 rounds. And all I have to say to that is that's a very good question.
I have two questions. questions. One is about social media, and the other is about the Open to All program here. I finally dropped the problem-riddled Facebook when I saw the New York Times story about racial exploitation, Facebook being used for racial exploitation, and people committing acts of violence based on what they'd seen on Facebook. But I've been using it as a political activist platform, so I'm wondering what to do with that conundrum. And then I'm just wondering how the Open to All program works here in Bozeman.
Okay, so did everybody kind of hear the question?
No.
Okay, great. So two questions, really. Number one, asking about the issue of social media, of using Facebook when it has come out, the extent to which Facebook is kind of scuzzy as a company, and specifically the sort of issues that they've had with their uses by racists, by white supremacists, and the sort of algorithms involved with that. Am I characterizing your question?
Russian interference.
Yeah, Russian interference.
Violent acts in people.
Right.
Get their news from
it. Yeah, the sort of instigation of Facebook. And then the second question was about our Open to All program, which we're involved with the Montana Pride Foundation. So as the sort of social media guy for Montana Rep, I run the Facebook page. And to some extent the Twitter. It is a really complicated issue, right? Like, Facebook is undoubtedly scuzzy as a company, and I'm intensely aware of that every time that I interact and post with both my personal and the organizational Facebook, but at some point you have tools available to you, and I think that using that tool as thoroughly as you can, sort of in the opposite direction from these instigatory, these racist, these white supremacist issues, is you know, sort of a subversive thing to do. And I like being subversive. I know I look like super subversive, but I do. So I would say, you know, I don't think that there's anything wrong in choosing not to interact with Facebook. I think that that's a perfectly valid moral choice to make. I also think that if you choose to use Facebook to try and reach people, you know, in a sort of social justice activist way, I think that that's an equally valid choice to make. And I would say that a lot of pressure is being put on Facebook, and, you know, this is life under late capitalism, just as you put pressure on your elected officials, you know, as a consumer, put pressure on the groups that you consume from, not just Facebook, but this is an across-the-board other action step that you can take. If you are a consumer of something and you feel like that company is not doing a great job of engaging with racial issues or with social issues, like, call them out on it. Call them out on Facebook, on Twitter. Write them a letter. And, you know, it's sort of ridiculously optimistic to say that as a consumer you have all or even most of the power under late capitalism, but you do have a measure of power as a consumer, and, you know, feel free to use that. And Judith is going to talk about Open to All.
Okay, so Open Pride Foundation operates in 5 Northwest states, including Montana. And here in Montana, there is a business initiative called Open to All. And that is for businesses, organizations, nonprofits, institutions to proudly say that they welcome anyone of the LGBTQI A plus community, not only as customers, but as clients, but as employees. If they have control over the labeling of the bathrooms, then they will make sure that they are non-gender specific. Some companies can't do that because they're shared bathrooms with other companies. But we do have over 60 organizations here in this valley that have signed up for the business initiative Open to All. If you go onto the Pride website and go to Montana, put in Open to All initiative or whatever, you'll see 57 there. I know it's more than 60. They just are having problems updating it. And we actually have forms over here, which if you do have a business, you're in charge of that business, you can you can sign up to be a part of it, and we'll later get you a cling you can put on your window or your glass door, something that shows open to all. And she's going to go over here, and she's going to show you this stuff. You want to just hold it up? Yeah. She's one of our great volunteers who's been working on the program. So we always like to bring that along. So it's not for private individuals, it's for businesses. It's even for nonprofits. So it's a good thing. It's a really, really good thing. Yes?
Are there any programs that operate at the school level that you know of in the Bozeman area? Because so much of that starts so young, and I wondered what the experience was here in Bozeman.
Well, that's a very timely question. She wanted to know, are we operating in schools, or is any other organization operating in schools here? John, would you like to say something about what you've done so far?
John Heilman, everybody.
Yes, I work for her. I have given a couple of lectures, in services, trainings, one at middle school and then at Bozeman High School. And from the reaction of the students, there's not a lot of sophistication about racial matters. One thing that happened at Bozeman, I was talking to the gifted and gifted and talented group, and we talked about microaggressions, and there was a minority girl, probably a freshman, who said, "What should I do if people are picking on me because of the color of my skin?" And
that's heartbreaking.
There was absolutely no reaction from the kids. You know, you'd think somebody would have said, "Well, call on me, I'll help you." Nothing. So now that's very limited, but I would say that the material that was up here on the screen is really not comprehended in Bozeman schools, because schools are a reflection of the community. Police departments and schools are what the community wants, because community has control of them in general. Bozeman is a nice white operation. Nice. We don't want to make waves, and so much of this is uncomfortable. Judith's statement about white people are in charge of fixing this because they made the mess. No. Okay, so that's from very limited experience, but that is my experience.
Says the retired high school teacher.
So I actually, in relation to this, I've recently been asked by one of the clubs at Bozeman High to come, and I'm going to do essentially a two-part bystander intervention / how to talk to your friends, how to talk to your relatives about race presentation for them. So I'm actually very excited. I feel like there's a general movement in Bozeman sort of slowly towards opening up more and more opportunities similar to that. We got all kinds of questions all over. So
could I just briefly follow up on the school piece? Because there's actually a number of students from Bozeman Field School.
Yeah, I didn't want to, like,
high school here.
Yeah, I didn't know if it was cool to, like, single y'all out. But yeah, thank you very much for coming.
Do you want to stand up, please?
And so there's a group of 10 high school students here. Bozeman Field School is a small independent high school that started this year. We have 9th and 10th graders here. And I'm not going to put my students on the spot and expect them to speak at this moment, but I do know that they have a wide range of experiences as individuals and within a variety of school systems in the area. So if folks are curious about what their experience has been in middle school or elementary school, you might be able to get it firsthand, but maybe after the big Q&A.
And also, don't expect them to answer. No, I'm totally serious that that if a white person asks, in particular, somebody who's a minority, somebody who's HMDO, a question, that they don't have to answer that question. Because sometimes there's a lot of trauma behind it, the answer. And so we may not want to answer the question. Yes, Gail? You were going to say something?
Well, that's...
I'm sorry, Beth.
I was just going to point out that it's part of this way that we have this other. So we have a politician that's really powerful. I can't remember his name, but anyway. He's always sort of differentiating. So you have to choose a side. The Black Lives Matter, the Blue Lives Matter. Or kneeling at a anthem is against the military. The military fights for that right. And he seems to think that every person of color lives in a ghetto, including John Lewis. And so I think what's happened is there's all these perceptions that are put on everybody, actually, white people, people of color, and until we can sort of get around these insane things that are being promoted on Facebook. You mentioned it. On Twitter, you see it sometimes. And today, in those books you guys are reading, too, that book, The End of Policing, we have it at the library, really gets you there safely. You can explore it.
No, that's good. That's good. We have time for one more question. Yes, please.
One of the reasons that I came here is...
Would you stand up and speak louder?
Oh, sure. I guess.
Thank you.
One of the reasons that I came here is I clearly understand that happens, everything that you have on the screen. We don't usually see that in Bozeman. That doesn't mean we don't have racism in Bozeman. But we don't usually see the person getting shot in 2.5 seconds, you know, all that. So in order for me to be less blind, I would find it very helpful to know more about the racial incidences that we do have in Bozeman, to be a more intelligent bystander, to be a part of the solution rather than the blind person.
I can.
Yeah.
If you want it. I'm going to take this question because Judith experiences this ties in. This actually meshes perfectly. These two questions and this sort of issue of asking a minority person for their experience. Judith fields a lot of these questions, and it is incredibly exhausting to talk about bad things that have happened to you. So I definitely respect your... I'd like to give a couple of experiences that I have had, if you feel that would be helpful, with my niece and nephew who are Black. They're actually biracial, Black and Asian, but they will never ever be seen as anything but Black children, as Black adults. I was at the 4th of July parade in Ennis. This was, I'm going to say 2 years ago, because my son, who is now 5, was old enough to eat candy, and he was super excited. No, like, you have no idea how big of a deal it is the first year that you're big enough to eat candy. You're going to the 4th of July parade in Ennis, and it's thick on the ground. So I was sitting at the 4th of July parade in Ennis. I had my then 3-year-old son, my niece and nephew would have probably been 5 and 6 that year, I'm going to say. My grandmother-in-law, their great-grandmother, who is white, my in-laws, who are white, my husband, who is white. We were all sitting in a row. So here, over here is great-grandma, grandma, grandpa, my niece and nephew, who are Black, my white son, me, and my white husband. These children were pretty clearly here with our family. I'm sorry. And as we're sitting at the 4th of July parade in Ennis, a little girl... She was probably 10. I don't think she could possibly have been more than 11. Came along with the bag of candy, and I watched as she took a piece of candy out of the bag, walked past my nephew, walked past my niece, put the piece of candy in my white child's hand, and kept going. And the worst part about it wasn't, I mean, I'm not the black person who experienced this, so I can't tell you for sure what the worst part was for them. Although I know that they knew, because I could see it in their eyes, that they knew she'd done it on purpose to them. The worst part about it was white grandpa saw it happen and said and did nothing to acknowledge that it had happened.
So saying something will be a helpful...
Say something. If you see something, say something. Because it's terrible.
Silence is complicity.
Yeah, it's terrible to have something bad happen to you, but it's even worse to have somebody watch something bad happen to you and then pretend that it didn't happen, which is what white great-grandma, not to put her on the spot as the bad person in this scenario, but she tried to make it seem like it definitely was not a big deal and could not possibly have been on purpose. It's worse not to hear it, that it's not okay. I mean, there are a lot of stories I could tell you. There's a lot of passive-aggressive refusal of service that happens. People of color will find themselves being served after a white person, being ignored until a white customer comes in, and then, oh, all of a sudden, I see you there. You person of color who's been standing here for 15 minutes. I would also say... So first off, I would say the internet is great. And I realize that depending on your level of comfort with the internet that you may not be used to it, but the internet is full of stories from people of color who have chosen to share their experience. And I would really encourage you to seek those out, because that's a scenario where the person has chosen to put their trauma out there and chosen to present it, versus putting somebody you know or don't know on the spot and saying, tell me about the worst thing that's happened to you this week. The only other thing that I would say is that I honestly think, and I say this with all respect for the Bozeman Police and the Gallatin Valley Sheriff's Office, because they are lovely people on the whole, but these things don't just happen in places where it's full of bad cops. The only reason that we haven't had a black child shot 2.5 minutes after the cop rolls up is because, two and a half seconds after the cop rolls up, is just because it hasn't happened here yet. We are no less racist of a place because there are fewer people of color for it to be enacted upon. And so I would say that part of it is just learning to be aware, is just learning to think about it, you know, is learning to see it happen and go, wait a second, that's not right. And then the next step is to do something about it. If you are a white person, you have a tremendous amount of power. Even I like to describe myself as fat, queer, and crazy. You can ask me about any of those labels. Even I, who am marginalized in other ways, have a ridiculous amount of social power in the United States. And so I consider it my responsibility, as I feel every white person should, to be willing when the time comes to be the human shield, to step up, to say something, to talk to the person this is happening to see what they need and how I can help in that situation. Which we lead a 6-hour workshop on how to do that safely and effectively. As well as tools you can use for talking to your friends and relatives and having that racist Thanksgiving dinner that I know you're all looking forward to.
We are beyond time. We really have to close up, but I would just say you need to open your eyes, all of you, because this is happening all around you all the time. And all the different things, most of the different things that have happened to me in this town, in this state, have happened within sight and hearing distance of white people who have not acknowledged it.